From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away this week. Today's show covers a number of topics, from an all-natural form of pesticide to the latest on Rocky Mountain Power's attempt to raise solar power rates and fees, and to how the county's community garden fared this summer. First up is Dan Steed. He's owner and operator of Nature's Balance Pest Control. Nature's Balance uses an all-natural organic means of controlling nuisance bugs and pests. I should know because last week Dan came to my place to manage a growing yellow jacket problem I was having on my back deck. We'll give you the details on what he did, why it works, and why it's all natural. Then, last week, Rocky Mountain Power agreed to drop its bid to make immediate and wholesale changes to the way customers with rooftop solar pay for their power, and instead will slowly phase in increased changes to net metering rates and fees over the next 18 years. Luke Carton, Park City Municipal's Environmental Sustainability Manager, closely followed this negotiation, and he will join us in the second part of the show to provide the details on what Rocky Mountain Power says they will do and what it means to present and future solar energy owners. Finally, it's post-Labor Day. Although you wouldn't know it from the record temperatures we're having, our growing season is beginning to wrap up. We'll talk to Ken Culloch, Executive Director of the Summit Community Gardens, on how their garden is surviving this heat wave and possibly the warmest summer on record. All that and some news on how antidepressants are getting into the Niagara River and bioaccumulating within the livers, brains, and reproductive systems of fish in the parts per billion. I know that doesn't sound like a lot, but it's thousands of times more than the concentrations recorded just 10 years ago. You'll soon get your dose of Prozac and Paxil from your fish oil supplement. We don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away this week. Well, last week, I was having a growing problem with some yellow jackets nesting, building a nest on my back deck under some eaves, etc. And I tried some standard pesticides, including a foam designated to supposedly kill yellow jackets and bees, and wasps. It says right on the can, made for yellow jackets and wasps, and it didn't work. And we'll get to that in a little bit. Dan Steed is the owner and proprietor of Nature's Balance Pest Control, and he came to my place, and he took care of the problem using what he describes as an all-natural, all-organic means of a pesticide, basically. So he's here to talk about his business and what this pesticide is about and why it's all natural and what it and other pests that it controls. So, Dan, thanks for coming in this busy Tuesday morning.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So yeah, let's just start with the business. I mean, it's called Nature's Balance Pest Control.
That's correct.
And what you did at my place was apply a liquid to the nest that was a combination of different types of oils?
That's correct.
So what was it? Specific?
Our mixture includes a combination of peppermint, wintergreen, rosemary, cinnamon oil, garlic oil, an oil from the geranium flower called genera oil, and an oil from the chrysanthemum flower called pyrethrin.
All of those things?
All of those, yes.
And all of those things combined create a toxic liquid, in this case, to these yellow jackets.
That's correct.
Any one of them, as individuals, do they serve as kind of a natural pesticide to that plant, or
you know,
some
the pyrethrin is probably the most well-known of those, and that's a natural substance that occurs in nature.
Yeah.
Very expensive and doesn't have a very long longevity, so it doesn't have long residual. So it works well at the very beginning, but after a week or two, it's gone. And so that's why we include those other oils to create a better, longer-lasting solution.
Okay. So basically, again, what you did was this was just in a kind of a watery, oily-based form, and you just sprayed it up into the nest area in this case, kind of literally, you know, in addition to applying it, it kind of flooded them out too.
Correct.
But it only took about 15, 20 minutes. And it wasn't a huge nest, but they were gone, and they haven't come back, by
Great.
The way, Dan.
That's the intended result.
Okay.
Yes.
So why this method compared to, say, a more synthetic-based chemicals that are, you know, off the shelf that we see for sale at all the hardware stores?
Right. Great question. You know, my desire in getting into this business was to find a better way to apply products that aren't harmful to the environment, aren't harmful to people or pets. We know there's a great demand for that type of solution, and we've found a very good mix of customers that like our product, and it's a good niche to be in.
Now, this is in this case yellow jackets, and I guess it'll handle wasps. Obviously, you make sure they're not honeybees. And
correct.
That's a completely different scenario. You're going to work with honeybees in a different
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. So honeybees are very beneficial. They're
right.
a great, great insect, and we love honeybees. So whenever we encounter a case of honeybees, we're going to call a beekeeper.
Okay.
Beekeepers are anxious to get new bees to their hive, and so we will never treat a honeybee
okay.
colony.
So you recognize that. But what other pests does this type of oil-based natural mixture handle?
It works great on spiders. Spiders are a big issue here in Summit and Wasatch counties. We have great success with earwigs. We works on cockroaches, which aren't very common, but we do come across them occasionally. It will work
really?
On ants.
Up here?
Up here, believe it or not, yes.
Well, here's my global warning. Thanks to global warming, we're probably going to see more of them in the future,
right.
among all other manner of bugs and stuff. But there really isn't any bugs. Are there bugs that maybe this doesn't work on?
Well, ants are a little more challenging because they're subterranean. It will take out the ones on the surface, but you really need to take out the queen of the colony, which is below ground. We find it doesn't work quite as well for ants.
Okay. And then other critters, rodents or so?
Well, rodents are going to be a little bit gun-shy, I should say, around this product. They don't like peppermint, so it is a little bit of a repellent, but we use other products for rodents.
Okay. Is it harmful, per se, to plants that if you're spraying, you got to be mindful of where you're spraying? So if this lands on my plants, which it did,
right.
I don't see any problems.
No, absolutely not. We have many clients that have small gardens, flower beds. It's not harmful at all because it's natural ingredients again.
Okay, and after you left, my place certainly smelled quite a bit like all of those lavender, peppermint. It was a little pungent for a time. But actually, some people, I was speaking to someone who's used you in the past, they actually love the smell, the scent. I mean, it's certainly all natural.
Right.
It's not the smell of DEET. Or
no.
other deodorant or endrin or other types of synthetic
correct
types of insecticides. So that's a good thing.
It is. Most
and it's also
like it.
Safe for pets going around there and stuff. Okay.
Absolutely.
So, like you say, were you in the business previously using synthetic-based pesticides?
No, I wasn't.
Oh,
actually,
okay.
This is a new venture. We worked on perfecting this mix over years, and I saw an entrepreneurial opportunity about 10 years ago and have been going forward ever since. It's been great.
Really? Okay. So again, name of the company is Nature's Balanced Pest Control. So going forward, do you see a growing trend in this field that people are getting away, other pesticides, insecticide agencies, businesses are kind of moving to more natural?
Absolutely. It's certainly a trend in the industry, and more people are trying to move away from harmful chemicals, carcinogenic properties. There's a number of people that have had bad experience with those products, and so we totally want to get away from that.
Right. And again, this is this a mixture you make, or is it something that is sent to you in drums or some other
type?
Well,
it is a mixture that I make. We do buy in bulk the products and then mix them ourselves.
Oh, you do mix them yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can do your own bit of experimentation with different measures of different oils and see what the impacts are.
That's correct.
Is there any kind of research on that going on at the local universities or so looking into?
Not that I'm aware of here. I know there's a lot in California and Oregon. There's a lot of experimentation going on, and there's new products coming onto the market all the time. There's a number of over-the-counter products that are available to people to buy in the local Home Depot. I don't know their effectiveness, but I know what we use is working very well.
Would it work on, say, termites, or is it termites similar to ants in that, again,
termites,
you've really got to get to the queen?
Exactly. Are not going to be nearly affected as ants would be with this product. You need something a little more synthetic, a little harsher.
Yeah, that's a bigger issue.
Correct.
Any experience with, say, ticks or so?
It is effective on ticks.
Yeah.
Flies, we've had good success with flying insects. Mosquitoes, it works very well against deterring mosquitoes. So it's not only a product that will kill the animals, it also repels the insects.
Okay. Could I actually apply this on my skin?
I suppose you could. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. It happens to land on me all the time. I've not had any adverse reaction to it.
That's a good point. You didn't wear any protective clothing.
Very, very little at all. I had some,
you didn't wear
had
a mask or so?
No,
I mean,
no mask.
So actually it's safe for the operator.
Correct.
The applier of this.
Correct. So this is a FIFRA-exempt product, which is a B product, which the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't have to monitor or manage. Unlike a lot of other harsher synthetic chemicals, which the EPA does manage.
That's interesting. FIFRA exempt.
Correct.
FIFRA acronym for basically Pesticide Rodent Control Act.
Correct.
And so it's safer for the business owner, the employer, fewer permitting requirements.
Correct.
The storage requirements aren't as burdensome as if you had, again, drums of synthetic pesticides.
Exactly.
So from a business point of view, it's less costly, less...
Well, I wouldn't know if I'd say it's less costly. Actually, the materials themselves, the raw materials, are more expensive.
Okay.
But the regulations around it are
The regulations fewer. Are less burdensome.
Correct.
And if you have to get rid of this stuff, it's not a hazardous waste.
Correct.
Which these pesticides would be if you have drums of it and they go they expire or something, you have to get rid of them.
That's correct.
Okay, all right. So it's great. Like I said, it worked well in my place. Someone here on staff also spoke highly of you and your business. They've used you several times to control ants and earwigs. I think they mentioned. So it's called Nature's Balanced Pest Control. And you have a website, Dan?
We do. You can find us at greenpestguy.com.
Greenpestguy.com. All right. And go there. Dan Stead, he's the owner and proprietor of Nature's Balanced Pest Control. I want to thank you for coming in and sharing that information.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Let's take a quick break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Luke Carton from Park City Municipal's Environmental Sustainability Manager. He's going to talk about the recent agreement hammered out with Rocky Mountain Power on some proposed solar fees and rate structures, et cetera. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It's back, another exciting season of Park City Miners football, right here on KPCW.
Join the Miner broadcast group of Craig, Scott, Matt, Pete, new personalities Andy and Bob, along with Miss Morgan, the intern.
Friday Night Football Under the Lights is brought to you by
U.S. Bank Park City, Elliott Work Group, Miller Orthodontics, the UPS Store Park City, Wasatch Vision Center, and Land Solutions Planning and Design.
Go Miners!
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away this week. Joining me in the studio is Luke Carton. He's Park City Municipal's Environmental Sustainability Manager, and he'd been closely monitoring, if not involved, in the negotiations with Rocky Mountain Power on their proposed, let's say, changes they wanted to make wholesale and fairly immediate changes they wanted to make to their solar program, we'll call it, the rates and fees and structures that they oversee and manage with respect to solar power. And so some agreements made last week to change and modify some of that with the Public Service Commission. Luke, you're here to talk about the details.
Yeah, definitely. So the long story short of it, last November, Rocky Mountain Power proposed something called a temporary tariff and then a longer-term change to rooftop solar. And this agreement, these stipulations, are a step in the right direction. It comes down to what was going to be a huge financial burden for rooftop solar folks, and it could have also applied to grandfathered ones, so folks that already had solar on the roof. And this multi-party agreement gives solar a path forward. So that's kind of one of the key pieces. To walk through the basics of it. Mm-hmm. If you have rooftop solar on your house right now, or you get your application in by November 15th, you don't need to install by November 15th. You get your application in, and you have a year to do it for residential.
Right.
You'll be grandfathered, so you'll be under the current, it's called Schedule 135. So your solar bill will look like everyone's solar electric bill from here on out. After that, we shift into something called the transition period. Transition is for folks that are going to install, that are going to get their application in after November 15th. So let's say you do it next summer. You get the application in, or you do it in two summers. There is a new, easiest way to view it is you pay for the electricity that you take off the grid, and you get credited at 90 to 92.5% of what your retail electric rate is for what you put on the grid. So the easiest way to view it is you're using the grid as a battery storage. Rocky Mountain Power takes a fee of about 8% of your retail electricity rate.
Right.
So the easiest way to view it is just math. You take stuff off, you put stuff on. It's measured in 15-minute increments. And at the end of the month, they look at what you took off the grid and what you put on the credits. You mush them together and see what your bill looks like after that. And that's capped. So that's got a 170 megawatt cap. The easiest way to view that is that'll fill up in probably 2.5-3 years. And then after that, there's something called the export credit proceeding, which is a really fancy term to figure out, well, what is that value of solar that you're putting on the grid to the ratepayers and all the folks around you. The other key piece that people need to realize, though, that was a huge win was the residential solar tax credit. Utah's, it was going to sunset here pretty fast. It's at $1,600. And this agreement has Rocky Mountain Power, the state agencies where they can, a bunch of the solar groups, really big nonprofits like Utah Clean Energy, UC, and a couple other groups. They're going to lobby to extend that tax credit, the $1,600 through 2020, and then it'll step down $400 a year. So we actually would have a solar tax credit in Utah through 2024 if that gets passed. One other huge caveat on all this is it still needs to go in front of the Public Service Commission. So right. September 18th, that is the hearing on this. And I know it's a lot of technical information I just threw out there. Easiest way to find out more if you're really curious is just track me down. You can find me on the parkcity.org website, the city's website. Just call City Hall. Easiest way to do it is through email because I can walk you through it, kind of spell it out. Just luke.carton@parkcity.org, or like I said, my email's on the website under environmental sustainability. We can walk you through it, show you the timelines. I can show you all those pieces as well. But the key things to realize is if you get your application in and you install by next year for residential, you're grandfathered. That's an awesome rate. Then the transition class piece, same thing. It's actually a decent rate. And then post-transition class, a little bit of a Wild West, but the goal is going to be to figure out what that value of solar is to the grid. So
okay. So basically, before November 15th, everything remains as is.
Correct.
And so you get your application in before November 15th, maybe, you know, midnight November 15th or something like that. After that, these changes begin to phase in where, you know, it won't be the deal, let's say, quote unquote, will be a different.
Correct. And that's a key piece you hit on, Chris. And also another quick caveat is if you're a large, if large customer, like commercial class customer, it's a 6, 6A, 9 and 10 meter. And if you don't know what those are, you're not that. So we're talking major hotels. They actually have 18 months to install because it's just a more complex system.
Sure.
But yeah, November 15th, the you can view it as it switches into this new transition class. And then that post-transition class as well. So the export credit proceeding is going to be kind of the next battle of, all right, what is the cost versus benefit of this solar coming on the grid? There's huge benefits. An easy example is, you know, they don't have to transport electricity from very far away to get it here, and they lose about 9% of that electricity on the way. It just kind of dissipates.
It's
heat
right.
and resistance and all these other things. So that's going to be a really interesting battle to fight. Now, if that comes out super, super favorable, and you're like, oh, I'm grandfathered in, or oh, I'm in transition class, and that new rate's better, there's actually a piece in there that you can move to a newer rate class. So that's another cool piece is, let's say you're grandfathered in, and this post-transition future, everyone comes together and, hey, it's the value of solar is huge. You have that option to move to a newer rate class, which is another kind of huge win for the consumer.
Okay, so overall, is the solar industry pretty relatively happy about this agreement? Or
you know, just like any big negotiation.
There's a compromise.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Not perfect. Not everyone got what they wanted, but that's the point of being adults and coming together and working together, saying, hey, we need to figure this out. So the good thing is right now the numbers are going to be fairly firm between now and 2020. And then, you know, after that, the export credit proceeding will go on. And like I said, I don't see if there is a drastic change on that. We'll see. But the other thing that folks have to realize is, you know, you're going to start seeing battery storage really tick up in the next 5 years or so, mm-hmm. as the Gigafactory and all these other actually huge competitors come online. And so that's going to look different. The other piece I forgot to mention, Chris, was the grandfathering. Your rate is good and through the end of 2035. And then the transition class, your rate's good through the end of 2032. And everyone's like, well, what happens after that? Well, if I was a betting man, I would say that the utility financial model is going to look completely different by then. I mean, the utilities, you got to think of all the change that's going on for them.
Right.
So by then it'll be just, and you'll have to replace your panels anyway. So that's kind of where things sit. So,
right. You think ahead to 2032, like you say, that's 15 years from now. Lots of things are going to change. Look back to 2002,
yeah.
You know, 15 years ago, where we were with respect to solar and renewables and Rocky Mountain Power's business portfolio, it's changed dramatically in the last 15 years.
Yeah, so, and the key piece, too, is to realize that it's not just the solar panels that are going to be getting more efficient or the inverters, but think of electric cars. Electric cars is literally, it's a battery on wheels. So that interchange between your house and your vehicle can now be battery storage for your home. There's a cool project going on out in California. It's called Vehicle to Grid Technology. So they're actually using school buses to power schools. to shave the peak and all this other stuff. So there's a lot of things that are going to be very disruptive in the next even 5 years.
Disruptive so. In a good way.
Yeah, and yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All right, we're speaking with Luke Carton. He's Park City Municipal's Environmental Sustainability Manager. We're talking about the recent agreement between Rocky Mountain Power and, I guess to call it, the Public Service Commission with respect to solar rates and fees, proposed solar rates and fees and structures. But to summarize again, September 18th, there is a hearing at the Public Service Commission to go over and formalize this. So there is still maybe some changes.
Yeah. So currently there is one group opposing. It's called Western Resources Advocates, and it's like I said, I don't want to get into the overly technical arguments. It comes down to the increments that things are measured and a couple other pieces. So the Public Service Commission, you can view it as it's a quasi judicial board that will listen to the arguments being made, and because of the stipulation was signed by a lot of these interveners, what it's called. It's folks that, you know, have that kind of formal technical seat at the table. Park City was one, Summit County was one, and Salt Lake City was one, and Salt Lake County were one. Those are the municipalities that were involved. It's a very kind of procedural way to go about it. But the great thing is this hearing will then proceed, and then they'll say, all right, we have the stipulation groups, and then you have anyone who opposes. And right now there is a single group that is opposing, and it's, like I said, it's on the technical piece side. So the PSC will hear that, and then the PSC can issue a ruling. So they could either accept the stipulations, they could suggest modifications and see if the stipulation signers decide to modify, or they could blow it all up and everyone be, you know, taking the gloves off, and it'd be an exciting week down at the Heber Wells building. We'll see where it goes. My guess is when you have that many signatories, it'll probably go through. And like I said, it's a compromise. It's not perfect, but you know what? It provides a path forward for anyone who's interested in solar.
Okay. So to learn more, obviously you can go to the Public Service Commission's website, get it. Rocky Mountain Power website may have some info on it. Where else do you think people can go to learn?
There's actually been Utah Clean Energy has a good write-up on their webpage right now of trying to break it down. And like I said, it's really easy to get overwhelmed by the technical pieces. And they can also reach out to me too. When I was on with Leslie Thatcher last week, I had 8 people reach out just out of curiosity. And like I said, I can at least help you ferry through it. It doesn't matter if you're a city resident or a county resident or you hear this. Just let me know, because we were heavily involved in understanding what went on with this and all those pieces. So I'm very familiar with the 46 paragraph stipulations.
Okay, great. And obviously we're talking about the return on investment gets modified somewhat, your break even point, et cetera. Those are the financial end of what's going to change here.
Exactly, and that was the goal, was to kind of make the math a little bit more straightforward for folks that were looking at it, especially on the residential side. And like I said, it's still a little complex, but it was better than what was originally proposed of time of use and demand charges and all this other stuff for residential. Large scale businesses and the ski areas, they're used to dealing with demand charges and understanding that. At your house, it's a lot more complex. It would affect when you'd run your dishwasher, when you could even use a hairdryer. It's those types of pieces. So this is a simpler piece moving forward, and that was the goal, so that way you can kind of look at your financials and understand what makes the most sense for you.
All right. You know what? I would say let's take a break, but I've run through all my underwriters.
Perfect.
And so. Take a breath, and then we'll move on to a couple other topics. I just remind people that you're listening to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Co-host Nell Larson is away. I think she's doing some research in the Adirondack Mountains this week, so she'll be back in a couple weeks, and we'll get a download on her experiences back there. We were just talking about solar-related issues. As sustainability manager, you've got a whole host of other activities you're doing in the area of sustainability, energy, fuel,
yep.
Water conservation. Sustainability is a big umbrella that covers everything from, like we say, the fossil fuels consumed and tried to conservation practices with respect to fossil fuels, to water conservation, to landscaping, to construction. To waste management. The sustainability covers all of those things. We got another 5 or 6 minutes.
Yeah.
What else is happening?
Let me dive into a couple things. This upcoming council meeting will be the the rediscussion is a good way to put it, of the microtransit piece. So microtransit, you know, there was a lot of confusion out there. The easiest way to view it is, let's say I lived in Deep Park Meadows, and I was a mile and a half or 2 miles from a bus stop. You're not
going to... That's deep.
Yeah, that's Deep Park Meadows. Maybe you wander a little bit. Okay. Let's say a mile and a half. Mile. Right. Let's even say a mile. Yeah. Let's make it simple. A mile from a bus stop. You're not going to take the bus, especially if you have your skis and stuff like that. You're not going to hike a mile. Take the bus. Then, you know, so the goal of microtransit is to have, it's kind of like small transit on demand. It will get you from your house area to a major transit stop. So you could tie into like the Electric Express, or you could tie, you know, if you were in that Deep Park Meadows part, you could take microtransit to a bus stop. The bus will get you into town for dinner. And same thing, you just do it in reverse to get home. A lot of folks focused in on the electric vehicle piece, and a couple things to dive into that. First of all, yes, I understand that the perceived piece of, Park City has Tesla's picking you up.
Right.
But to step back, actually, the financials really make sense. The operating per mile and then also the warranties on these vehicles really make sense. You're going to start seeing some taxi cab companies across the country actually starting to jump into them. A couple of reasons why. First of all, the warranty on a Tesla, and this isn't me plugging them because the Bolts as well, is 7 years and it's unlimited warranty. So if you think if you're a high mileage business and you can have a 7 year vehicle with literally an unlimited mile warranty, that's a huge win. Also, the operating cost per mile is lower. And we've actually shown this with our buses. The electric buses are cheaper for us to operate per mile than a diesel bus. So you start thinking of that, and then you think of, you know, the electric vehicles are a simpler machine than an internal combustion engine. You know, you just, fairly simple concept. You know, you look at the Chevy Bolt, really, truly, the only fluid you have is like washer fluid, and you have to do your tires and
right.
a couple other pieces.
There's no oil.
Yeah, no coolant. No power steering fluid. No, you know, belts or anything like that. It's really kind of like I said. It's a battery on wheels with an electric motor and a transmission. And the transmission on our buses is low and high in reverse. So it's like I said. It's fairly straightforward, and that's why the electric piece is key. And also, you got to view it as the microtransit. It's a smaller vehicle than trying to run a 35-foot bus on regular increments through some of these more residential areas that aren't really built for those buses.
Right.
And like I said, to run a bus on enough frequency to get people to ride it. So the goal is let's tie these into our transit routes, especially like the Electric Express. If I'm going to take the Electric Express to Kimball Junction, I don't look at the schedule. I just go to the stop. If you miss the bus, you hang out for 10 minutes, the next one rolls in. So that's kind of the goal. It's very cutting edge the way all of this is going to tie together. But truthfully, the goal is to make it so you can get around town without having to use a car. You know, when you look at 30% of our vehicles in the city are circulating looking for a parking spot during peak times, imagine if you could just go into dinner without having to worry about, you know, where are we going to park? You know, then we got to walk out. We got to do, you know, it's just rely on the transit system. That's where pieces are going. So that's coming up. The other big thing people are going to start hearing about in the next few months is something called bioregional planning. We are doing a really cool program with Utah State University with our landscape architecture and natural resources group. And they're going to be out there looking at our different assets around the community, from open space to our water to a couple other pieces, and also overlaying that with the planning and population documents. And what we're doing at is looking at Park City. What will Park City look like in 2032?
Mm-hmm.
Or what are some of our potential outcomes there? So then we can start using that kind of forward-looking document to start making these planning changes and you know, having these community-wide conversations of, you know, here are different options. And it's not going to be, hey, this is utopia and this one is, you know, the gates of Hades. It's going to be, hey, here's some different ideas to look at, or here's some different ways to approach these complex issues. So that's going on as well, and that'll be exciting. We'll be definitely getting a lot of folks involved over the next few weeks and months on that.
Bioregional.
Yeah, so it's just not the city limits. It's actually looking at the overall Snyderville Basin, but also the county, and then also what's going on in this whole region of the Wasatch Front and the back and all the way out to Wyoming. So it's kind of looking at things as almost like a concentric circle.
Okay, and in maybe in forms of watersheds, because watersheds cross county lines,
exactly,
et cetera.
Yeah, that's so. One of the ways we defined it was watersheds, also some of the housing pieces, and also we truthfully wanted to look at some of the agricultural pieces in this. You know, for Summit County, it's I actually say it's what helps make Summit County Summit County is we are so politically diverse, economically diverse. It's a really impressive to see. You know, you have the Sundance Film Festival coming to town and all the glitz and glamour with that, but we also have some beautiful iconic ranches on the eastern side of the county. You know, we have folks that rely on the land, and it's truthfully understanding, going to them because they're the experts, and understanding what they see, what's going on, and where they kind of see their future going as well. So it's going to be fairly encompassing, and like I said, we'll be reaching out to a lot of key stakeholders, not only just in Park City, but also in the region overall. We're talking to the county, we're talking to the federal agencies, all these different groups to really kind of see what the current state is and understand these kind of different futures for our area.
All right. So that's what's happening. Here's one. Well, a few months ago, we initiated our plastic bag ban.
Yes.
And it's up and running.
Correct.
Right? Some stores have different programs associated with it. I know if I go to the market, and if I don't have my reusable bag, they have paper bags,
mm-hmm.
and they charge me a dime per bag. Okay? All right, that's met with some consternation from some folks. What is obviously we don't have any quantified information, just anecdotal per se. What kind of feedback have you been hearing?
So there is a survey going around by a community group, and it's still over 90% positively received.
Okay.
The amount of times I've gotten emailed to what's going on in Kenya the past few weeks is huge. So Kenya, so plastic bags are getting banned on the country level in Africa. And Kenya's is the most aggressive by far. And it's actually taken a few years to kind of step in. It went from, you know, kind of incentive to knowing this mandatory piece was coming. So if you flew to Kenya with a plastic bag, let's say you put your shower in a plastic bag, just a grocery bag, it will be taken from you in customs. If you are found distributing plastic bags in Kenya, it's a $40,000 fine and 4 to 6 years in prison.
Wow.
So, you know, it's
they're serious.
Yeah, because well,
cracking
the issue,
down.
Yeah, the issue is it's an impact on their more fledgling sewer systems in that side of it. The bags are, and the litter is a huge issue as well. So it's a huge piece around the world. We were actually just back in Colorado this past weekend visiting some friends. The town of Avon in Colorado is looking at doing it as well. It's chugging along. The interesting thing is, you know, if you go to the stores. Like I said, I believe a lot of folks get it, you know, and yeah. if you forget your own, if you forget your reusable bag, and you have to pay a dime for the paper bag, I've done it. Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. It's a stupidity tax on myself if I forget it. You know, that's the way I view
well,
it.
Well, I
me.
Used the bag too
yeah.
for some other purposes, or I reused the paper bag.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, everyone's been very positive about it. We do have an email address set up for both positive and negative feedback. It's bagban@parkcity.org.
Okay.
And there is the Park City Plastics Coalition, a group of citizens that are trying to come up with creative ways to address it and look at it and help kind of understand what's going on. And we do receive phone calls. We reach out to the stores.
Sure.
You know, it's just... It's up and running, and the sun still comes up tomorrow, and the moon still rises. So
okay.
It's good.
Thank you. We'll leave it at that. Lou Carton, he's Park City Municipal's Environmental Sustainability Manager. Again, the solar issue is really what we're interested in. The Public Service Commission hearing on September 18th to either, you know, modify, tweak, formalize this proposed change in solar power fees and structures and tariffs.
Yeah, and like I said, if folks have questions, look at Utah Clean Energy's website. We'll have some stuff up on our city website in the next few weeks too, as this gets formalized, or just truthfully just reach out. I can walk you through it.
All right. Luke, thanks as always for stopping by and keeping us posted, and we'll have you on again because this issue is evergreen in nature.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, thanks, Luke. All right, let's take actually we'll try to take a break. I'm going to play some music, so don't panic. I'll just play some music because I've run out of underwriters. When we come back, we're speaking with Ken Culloch. He is with Summit Community Gardens. Well, hopefully he'll be here to talk a little bit about what's going on there. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues. I'm Chris Cherniak, and joining me in studio is Ken Kulick. He's Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens here in town, or in Summit County. And he's here to talk about, well, basically, an event you got coming up.
Yeah.
And also what's going on at the garden. We haven't had you on all summer.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're just going to get a rundown since the growing season is sort of kind of wrapping up.
Kind of, yeah.
All right. Yeah. So let's start with, just in general, how things have gone this year at the garden. This is, the third year, fourth year?
This is the second full year with the new garden, yeah.
With the new garden.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So what's the takeaway?
Yeah, well, you know, since last year was really first about establishing the garden and getting all the infrastructure in place, and it was really the first year that we went back in this new garden. We rented out plots to gardeners, the community mm-hmm. gardeners. Last year we had about 80 to 85 gardeners. We established our demonstration garden last year also. And we ran some smaller, shorter kids classes. So this year we wanted to build upon that. And we thought that, you know, as the second year moves on, the garden is in place. We actually expanded a little bit. We got 90 community gardeners this year. We ran 4-week-long kids camps. We feel education is an important part of our mission.
Mm-hmm.
So we ran camps about, you know, insects and harvesting. And we had between 5 and 12 kids. So they were week-long, half-day camps and had a really good turnout there. And then we also continued what we called our Garden Bounty Project, which is our food donations. We essentially grow organic produce in our garden, in our demonstration garden, and we donate that to the local food banks. And so last year we donated 1,400 pounds of produce to the Christian Center.
Wow.
And also Community Action Services. This year we added People's Health Clinic to our recipients, and so we're at about 750 pounds this year. We had a goal of about 1,000. So, we feel it's really important to if people don't have access or are food insecure, make sure that they're getting healthy foods, and so that's kind of how the Garden Bounty Project started.
All right, and what's typically being grown in these plots?
Yeah, so think of it as a lot of greens. So we have kale and chard and lettuces and spinach. And then also root vegetables. We have carrots and radishes, turnips and beets. And then also some of the warmer season vegetables like squashes and tomatoes that we have growing too. So it's a pretty good variety that we have. We also have some broccoli, as I think about more.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's really good, healthy food. And there's in this climate, people don't think you can grow a lot. But, you know, you have to be smart about it. You have to understand when you have to put certain things in the ground, what you should start ahead of time, indoors, how you should cover it, all things like that. But you can grow a variety of produce here.
We're... pests a particular problem this year? I mean, they're always going to be around.
Yeah.
Anything unusual?
Yeah. I wouldn't say anything unusual. You know, aphids are always an issue.
Right.
In a community garden, when you have 90 different gardeners plus our own garden there, and we're kind of in the middle of a field, so you know you're going to get that. We did have to pull out some leafy greens that were infected, but you know you kind of expect that it's probably going to happen. You just hope to minimize it. And I think last year Lindsay, our garden manager, had found that she was covering a lot of the vegetables almost all the time. The sun could get in, keeps moisture in, but it also helps keep some of the pests out, and that helped a little bit as well. So it's a nice little tip. And our new garden manager, Sarah, and then assistant garden manager, Megan, have done a lot of that this year to help kind of prevent the spread. But, you know, it's just natural. It's something that's going to happen at community gardens.
And I don't have the numbers yet, but I'm pretty sure this summer was one of the warmer summers we've experienced.
Yep.
And I don't know how much rain you got, but you have plenty of water there to supplement growing. Now, going back to what you donate, this is from the gardeners themselves who kind of commit to giving some of their crops to the food banks?
Or this is actually food that we as an organization grow. So
okay.
In the middle of our garden, we have a demonstration garden. And in that demonstration garden, we grow, our garden staff basically grows those vegetables. We donate a majority of them. We're also going to have garden sales coming up where we sell our produce because we are a nonprofit. We rely upon the generosity of our community, grants, donations, and sponsorships and things like that to help keep our gardening community growing. You know, that's essentially
okay.
So that's really our own produce. We will ask the community gardeners if they have anything that they feel that they won't be able to harvest, let us know, and then we can add it to our donations that we give out a few times a week.
Okay, so they can certainly they can certainly chip in.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of donations and an event, you have an event coming up.
Yep. It's called Dig In, Dinner in the Garden. It is in partnership with Eats Park City. It's our second year. It's really a fun event. Last year we had over 300 people come to our garden, which, by the way, in case you don't know where it's located, because a lot of people don't know, we're right off Old Ranch Road on Shadow Mountain Drive, which is basically just past the Winter Sports School, and it's across the parking lot from Matt Canute Park. And essentially, it's a 1.5-acre fenced-in area. We have paths in there. We have a kids' garden. We have a beehive. You know, it's a lot of fun things. So last year, we had decided to do an event, kind of a community-oriented, family-oriented event, because September is Family Meals Month, and we felt that, you know, everyone can, you know, it's great to have everyone come together kind of as a community and eat dinner together. And so we decided to do it on a Sunday afternoon. This year it's September 10th between 3 and 6.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of maybe earlier in the day, a little bit later in the day, but a little bit before dinner time. You can actually have your dinner a little early and then go home and then kind of relax and enjoy. There are kids' activities, live music. We're expecting to have over 400 people this year.
400?
Yeah, we're at about 425. We have only two family sponsor tickets left, so you can go to either summitcommunitygardens.org or you can go to eatsparkcity.org, and you can still order those. But it's basically tickets for four, so we only have about 8 slots left.
That's it,
yeah.
Okay, you can't show up at the door.
No showing up at the door, I'm sorry to say, because we need to manage and understand how many people are coming, because we're going to have a lot of great food. We're going to have ribs and smoked chicken legs, and we have a lot of support from a lot of other food sponsors. We have corporate sponsors.
Okay.
Anyway, so it's really going to be a fun event. We're going to have face painting. We're going to have coloring. We're going to have goats, by the way. Shrek and Fiona are going to make their second appearance. Who doesn't want to see a goat, right?
Right, maybe we'll do some – I was going to say, can you get some people to do some weeding while you're at it?
You know what?
Weeding competition?
We can just send them in the back over there and just take care of it.
Let the goats take care of that.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's Dig In.
Yep.
How long does the season, quote-unquote, last? Is there a formal closure to the garden?
There really isn't, right? And part of it is because, you know, the cool season vegetables you can grow into October in some cases, as long as you keep them covered. But basically last year I was looking back on my notes and we were actually donating into November. It was a warmer fall. But so basically, you know, the season starts in theory, the last frost is usually in mid-June, but you could start some of your stuff for a little bit earlier.
Right.
You could start them indoors and you could also direct sow as long as they don't kind of come up through the soil. And then so typically it's usually maybe the end of September, early October. If it's warmer, then you can get into October and do it.
Yeah.
But you could certainly grow things like root vegetables and greens, you know, later in the season. So you can extend it a little bit. And then if you kind of cover them or build little hoop house, you know, little hoops.
Into the garden.
Yeah. The gardens will stay open until really there's snow.
Okay.
We might clear out the demonstration garden and we might, you know, do our thing.
Right.
But basically, if you're a community gardener and you're renting for the season, you can basically continue it. for as long as you possibly can.
Okay, so going forward, you said you had 80, 85 plots?
We had this year we had 90.
90?
Yeah.
Is there actually any more room for more?
We do have more room. We'll have to actually till and rip the land and basically build a new section and add irrigation.
Oh, okay.
But we have plenty of room to do that. It's just a matter of just understanding what the demand is going to be moving forward.
Right.
Each year it seems like there's more and more demand.
Yeah.
So it just depends upon how many people renew, which will open that up in October, and then how many more people want to come on in. And we have a wait list right now. It's been pretty popular, and I think people enjoy the experience. You know, it's about getting people together as a community, people sharing ideas, learning from each other, and just a camaraderie amongst fellow gardeners.
And maybe serve as a seeding for other community gardens in the area, whether they're HOA-related or other neighborhood community gardens. There's a lot to learn from your group.
Sure, certainly.
All right, definitely. And then your website?
It's summitcommunitygardens.org.
All right. That's it. Again, dig in. There's only a couple tickets. Go to the website
Sunday.
Okay. Yep. This Sunday. Ken Kulick, Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate it.
All right. One last break, and we'll be back to wrap up. You know what? Forget it. We're not going to take any any breaks. Thanks, Ken, for stopping by. I will. I've got a couple minutes. I want to get this news item in. A study done on the river system, the Niagara River, which separates Lakes Erie and Ontario. And it basically summarizes this: the continuous release of pharmaceuticals into freshwater systems impacts the health of aquatic organisms. And these pharmaceuticals come from us and our waste stream. The study evaluated the concentrations and bioaccumulation of pharmaceuticals and the selective uptake of antidepressants in fish from the Niagara River. The Niagara River receives pharmaceuticals from different wastewater treatment plants along the river and in Lake Erie. Of the 22 targeted compounds that this study looked at, 11 were found at part per billion levels in the wastewater treatment plant effluents and at part per trillion levels in river water samples. Now, that's obviously, those are small concentrations, but the fact that these concentrations are now showing up in part per billion levels, which is 1,000 times more than part per trillion, is pretty astounding. The major drugs observed were the antidepressants Celexa, Effexor, Paxil, and Zoloft. These antidepressants accumulate in various fish organs, with some bioaccumulating up to 3,000 times in the liver of some fish sampled. The antidepressants were selectively taken up by various fish species at different trophic levels or depths and were further metabolized once inside the organism. The highest bioaccumulation was found in the brain, followed by the liver, muscle, and reproductive systems. And again, they can be attributed to the direct exposure to the wastewater treatment plant effluent. So interesting stuff about how we are impacting the environment and, in this case, impacting fish with our antidepressants. Hey, got to wrap up. I want to thanks to our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah, Republic Services, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, Vail Epic Promise, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and of course, listeners like you. You can always join us on Facebook at KPCW, This Green Earth. Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM, Park City.